Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it take to get new and expecting mothers and their children off to a healthy start? And what unique obstacles do low-income families have to overcome in order to take good care of themselves? My guests today have worked with patients, community leaders, and their colleagues in the health industry to try and identify effective and affordable solutions to these challenges, both locally and in the developing world. Dr. Elizabeth Melendez is Interim Director for the Obstetrics and Gynecology Residency Program for Methodist Health Systems. Dr. Eric Bing is Global Health Director for the George W. Bush Institute and author of the book Pharmacy on a Bicycle, Innovative Solutions to Global Health and Poverty. Both participated last week in a panel discussion on maternal and childhood health at the Bush Presidential Center, sponsored by the United Way of Greater Dallas and the Kimberly-Clark Corporation. Welcome both of you to Think.
Thank you.
Great. Thanks for having us here.
What is the relationship between overall family income, typically, and health and wellness for families with young children?
Well, I think one of the things that I think it's important for us to distinguish is lack of access to care and poor health. Mm-hmm. That families who don't have access to care will have poor health of themselves as well as their children. And often that is totally related to poverty, particularly here in the United States, but it doesn't have to be. The poor are more likely to be sick and not get their kids' care, but often that has to do with lack of access to care.
And the only other thing I'd add, Chris, is that poor education is very well correlated with poor health outcomes. And I think that when you talk about low-income communities where education can be questionable, then you will see sort of that cycle of poor health following the pattern of low income and low education attainment.
So does lack of education mean that people are essentially making uninformed decisions about their own health?
I guess what I'm referring to is education as a whole. So completion of high school, completion or even any college education, that leading to misinformation regarding health, appropriate lifestyle choices, dietary, nutritional choices, and things of that nature. There have been correlations made between people who don't have high school degrees, their inability to have good incomes to make a good living, and their inability to then access health systems in an appropriate manner.
And I think that one of the things that Liz is really pointing out is that there's a correlation between it. So lack of education doesn't mean that you're going to have bad health. However, certainly there's a lot of things that go along with poor education that also may lead to lack of good health.
So let's talk about impediments to access to care. There is, of course, the question of money and people who feel that they can't afford preventative health care or ongoing health care. But there are other practical issues that middle class families who may be listening might not even relate to or have considered in terms of just being able to get across town to the doctor.
Sure. We see that all the time in our residence clinic where we have patients. The other day, we had a patient who walked to her visit for an hour to get with her newborn baby to get to her appointment. So things like missing a bus that maybe comes once an hour or not having someone to take care of the other children in the household so that the mother or woman can make it to that doctor's appointment, not being able to take time off of work. There are women who have two or three jobs and really don't have time to see a doctor during the normally scheduled appointments. All of those are impediments, barriers that we sort of have to become creative in order to overcome them.
Yeah, so it seems to make sense. Everyone sort of expects that medical buildings will be, these big, fancy, well-equipped spaces, and this is where a lot of people have come to expect care. But there are times when sort of going out into the community works better in serving those communities.
No, absolutely. One of the things that we have certainly seen in developing countries is that child mortality has dropped by 40% in the past 20 years. And a lot of it is the way we approach access to care for these very poor people who have major impediments in their life. Is if they can't come to us, it's important for us to actually go to them. And many of the models that have begun to be developed in many developing countries have looked at how do you bring care to people who need it.
Mm-hmm. And another thing that you've looked at in the developing world is services provided by people. You know, some things clearly we need an MD to take care of. Some things a nurse practitioner might take care of. Some things a trained local resident might be able to help with.
Absolutely. And I think that one of the things that I think is important is looking at the ability, the skills to actually do something that's actually quite simple, like take a blood pressure, like give a vaccination, like teach a mother how to breastfeed her baby. These are things that local community people actually can do and are being trained to do quite effectively.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number if you'd like to join the conversation. You can also send email to think@kera.org. So what kinds of health education makes sense for what we call at-risk parents? Maybe I'll step back from that actually and ask first, what is an at-risk parent? Or who is an at-risk parent?
Usually the women that we identify as being at risk are young mothers, so teenage moms are considered to be at risk, and women living in lower socioeconomic settings, and usually that means women of immigrant status or women of African American or Latino backgrounds, because they do disproportionately tend to live in these low-income settings. And so those are the patients that we sort of identify as being at risk for poor outcomes, either poor maternal outcomes or poor infant outcomes. Here recently, one of the growing groups of at-risk women are women whose BMIs put them in the morbid obesity category. And so those are women in whom we are finding many more complications during the pregnancy that can significantly impact the outcome of their unborn child.
And this is happening even among younger mothers.
The morbid obesity. Yeah. Absolutely. It's quite unfortunate. It's, you know, we throw around the term epidemic very loosely, but it is a rising number, and it is, you know, we see it obviously in childhood. Most recently, we've heard a lot of discussion about childhood obesity. And so our mothers, young mothers, already have many problems usually reserved to the older moms, like diabetes and hypertension, because of the obesity problem.
Yeah, and also, you know, piggybacking on what Liz says, you know, this, you know, delaying childbirth to the time that a woman is really able to bear and take care of a child is incredibly important. You know, the child of a mother who is a teenager, at least in the developing world, is about 35% more likely to die under five than a mother who's delayed to her 20s. And then also the other thing is about spacing children. If the children are spaced too close together, it's really hard for a mom to give the child the kinds of care that she needs. And, you know, certainly worldwide, we could probably save about 2 million children just by spacing children out 3 years, giving a mother a time to take care of the child, nurture the child, and then bring another child into the world.
What's the relationship between access to family planning services and delaying of childbirth or spacing children out in a more optimal way?
It's a great question. You know, certainly if you don't have access to contraceptives, and when you desire them, it's really hard for many women to avoid pregnancies. And that's a major problem, particularly in the developing world. In Africa, about 75% of all women who would like to have contraceptives don't have access to them. And so they're having children not because they want to have more, but they don't have access to basic contraceptives.
And sadly, Chris, the problem isn't just in the developing world. Here in the U.S., the numbers of unplanned pregnancies still are at about 50% women reporting that, and I say unplanned versus unwanted because it's not necessarily that they don't want the pregnancy once they become pregnant, but it wasn't a planned pregnancy.
Right.
If they had had other options, they would not have gotten pregnant at the time. And what that does for women of any socioeconomic status is obviously puts a burden on what their life will be like for the next few years. If you factor in the pregnancy, the postpartum recovery, if there's any breastfeeding involved, and what that can do to their earning potential because of time off of work or growth in careers for women that are out in busy careers, it's a really important issue. And so for me, access to contraception is really the most important issue that I deal with our patient population and trying to make sure that they access it when they have the means to gain it.
I know that you're a gynecologist, but I wonder if we also need to do a better job at educating young men about the importance of contraceptive use.
Absolutely, because I think one of the barriers that many women face is their partners don't want them to be using contraceptives or will put some barriers in their way. And I think that if men were as motivated to avoid pregnancy as many women are, we'd have a lot fewer unwanted or unplanned pregnancies.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, Chris, at our Golden Cross Academic Clinic, we have a model of prenatal care called Centering Pregnancy. And we invite the partners of these young women because one of the group's themes is to target teen pregnancies. We invite the partners to come and participate in the educational components of that prenatal care visit. And one of the very big ones is contraception and why it's important. We've gotten very positive feedback from the young men that have participated in that program.
And is the response that like they hadn't been aware or they hadn't fully understood or they had just bad information about what gets, I mean, everybody knows what gets you pregnant, but you know, that a less effective method was somehow going to help?
It's all of the above. I think they often don't know that all it takes is once.
Mm-hmm.
They don't know that there are methods that don't require you to remember to take a pill every day. And they don't recognize how hard it is to remember to take a pill every day, or the fact that their government assistance might not be around forever. And so all of a sudden they've had a baby. 6 weeks later, they no longer have insurance. And so when they go to access either more birth control pills or another contraceptive injection, they now don't have the means to access that. And so most of that comes from just lack of knowledge. They don't know better. And so that is why, you know, distributing that information in a meaningful way is so important for us.
We're speaking this hour with Dr. Elizabeth Melendez, who is Interim Director for the Obstetrics and Gynecology Residency Program for Methodist Health Systems, and Dr. Eric Bing, Global Health Director for the George W. Bush Institute and author of the book Pharmacy on a Bicycle. Both participated last week in a panel discussion at the Bush Presidential Center, sponsored by the United Way of Greater Dallas and the Kimberly-Clark Corporation. We'll come back to this talk in a couple of minutes and invite you to get on the line to join us. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/mls.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour about maternal and childhood health with Dr. Eric Bing, who is Global Health Director for the George W. Bush Institute and author of the new book Pharmacy on a Bicycle. Dr. Elizabeth Melendez is with us as well. She's Interim Director for the Obstetrics and Gynecology Residency Program for Methodist Health Systems. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. It's interesting, Eric. I think a lot of people think, okay, there are health problems and issues we deal with in this country, and then there is, you know, we just sort of make the developing world into this other thing and assume that their problems are nothing like ours. And it sounds like your experiences have been that many of the challenges and frankly many of the solutions might be more closely aligned than people realize.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think that one of the things that is certainly clear to us is that sort of national boundaries are illusions. I mean, because diseases don't recognize those. And the things that people are challenged with elsewhere are very much relevant to what we are doing here. And so some of the solutions that are actually happening abroad are also relevant as well. So, you know, we've been talking about the importance of prenatal care and early childhood care. And I think some of the solutions that we're beginning to look at in developing countries point some ways that we actually can be also effective here. Because these countries don't have the resources, what they've had to do is to be very efficient and effective at getting care out there. So rather than people coming to the doctor, they've actually now sent care out to people. And that's one of the things that we talk about on Pharmacy on a Bicycle, our recent book, sort of focusing on this, is how to get care out there. A lot of the models or a lot of the ways that countries are being very, very effective is by using community health workers who actually live in communities, who understand what's going on there, to give out basic preventive messages. Rwanda, in just 10 years, has been able to reduce maternal and child mortality 60% just by moving care to the communities, and they do it with volunteers.
And I have to imagine there is a multiplier effect even in this country when you deal – you can't reach every at-risk young mother in the greater Dallas area. But when you reach one, does she talk to her girlfriends and her cousins and her sisters about what she's learned?
Absolutely. I think that particularly women, when they find a good care provider, will tell everybody. And I can tell you as an OBGYN in talking with colleagues in private practice, that's much of how they get their patient population comes from word of mouth to some extent. But as far as disseminating good, correct information and, unfortunately, wrong information, sisters talk to sisters, cousins speak to cousins, friends talk to friends. And so that's why for us it's so important to educate every one of the patients that walks in our door, because our hope is that she is going to disseminate that correct information and try to dispel some of the myths about many of the things that young women of reproductive age go through that get perpetuated by women who don't know better.
Yeah, what have you both learned about communicating, you know, your years and years of medical training and knowledge to people who may have less than a high school education, may in parts of the developing world may not have even become fully literate? How do you sort of decide the most important pieces of information to give out and the ones that you really need to stick, knowing that you can't sort of explain everything?
Well, I think there are sort of basic, simple messages that people can understand. Mm-hmm. And I think sort of breaking things down to what the core message is, whether it is get prenatal care, make sure you get your child immunized at this time, and I will call you up to make sure that you have the resources or the necessary means to get there. I think these really basic things are important. But I also think that it's important for, particularly when you're using community health workers, is for them also to be connected to a health center, mm-hmm. so that when they get over their heads or they get at questions that they can't answer, there's somebody actually there who can help. I think often when we're talking about real relatives or friends that we are also relying on, when they're stuck, they make it up. and I think often. and I think, you know, having people who are trained but very similar to the people you're trying to reach but who are connected to those who have the knowledge and resources is absolutely really, really helpful and pretty critical in helping to alleviate some of the problems that we're seeing.
Where we see that often, Chris, is in our attempt to educate young women about the benefits of breastfeeding.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for many years, the idea that formula is better than breast milk has sort of been perpetuated, and now we have to go back and sort of dispel some of that misinformation and try to educate women on those real benefits. And what we found to be very helpful is to engage community leaders or just lay people to come and talk and to these group of young women and give their thoughts on, well, this is how I made it work, instead of a doctor in a white coat telling them, this is, you can do this, just, you know, try harder.
Mm-hmm.
It's been really effective. The other area where we found success is in conversations around domestic violence. We found that having peers talk to one another in a group setting about the potential for domestic violence, what it really means. Some people wouldn't define verbal abuse as domestic violence or contraception tampering as domestic violence, but all of those things really do fall within that definition. And having peers talk to each other about it has really gone a lot farther than physicians trying to fish that information out of the patients when we have the 15-minute visit.
And one of the things that that's really, you know, important about, and I'm glad you brought this up, Liz, is that when you bring this out into the community, you can begin to change the culture. You can begin to change the norms. You can begin to change the expectations. And that begins to be sustainable.
One thing that really stuck with me, and I think it was you who said it, Liz, in this conversation we had last week at the Bush Center, was that compliance rates for childhood vaccines are actually higher among lower income families than they sometimes are among families of means. Can you talk about that? It's certainly a subject that has come up on this show before, this sort of relatively new sense among quite well-educated people that there might be something dangerous or hazardous about vaccines.
Yeah, I think that when it comes to certain, and I'll say just certain communities of in the lower income status, there is a certain amount of paternalism that they allow the physician to engage in. And so they will, as long as they have access to the care, they will follow through with whatever instructions or recommendations the physician is giving to them.
Like
their
the doctor
family.
Must know best. So yeah.
Exactly. It has been shown that as certain communities become more highly educated and look for information on their own, I won't say there's a distrust that's developed, but there's certainly more questioning and more doubt about those supposedly tried and true recommendations. And so I think one of the perfect examples is in the controversy surrounding vaccinations and their potential believed correlation with autism. And so when you look at those people who were choosing not to vaccinate their children, so it's a conscious decision. It's not a matter of not being able to make it to the doctor during that first year or what have you. But those people that are choosing not to do it tend to be the groups that are in a higher socioeconomic bracket.
Do you think some of the resistance may be the fact that a lot of, you know, 21st century parents have not seen a child suffering through whooping cough, have not heard of someone with diphtheria, have not seen so much as a case of the mumps, and assume that these things are not as bad as they can be?
No, absolutely. I think, you know, when you've not seen children dying of this, when you've not seen children getting really, really ill from these things, then it's very easy for our perceptions to be altered because you just haven't seen it before. But it does have ramifications. The Bush Institute and its partners are currently working on a program called Pink Ribbon, Red Ribbon that aims to reduce cervical cancer and breast cancer in developing countries, primarily sub-Saharan Africa right now. And the controversies around HPV vaccines for young girls is really now beginning to affect some of those countries. So for we work in Tanzania, and there has been significant concerns in the public that, well, why would we take these from the Americans when the Americans don't trust these vaccines either? But the Americans don't, we don't have the kind of problems that they have. You know, we have about 500,000 women each year who are getting cervical cancer. And almost all of them are in developing countries. And almost all of them are dying in developing countries. And so these countries need these vaccines. However, they're also influenced by what they hear in our own press.
Let me jump in. Cervical cancer is proven to be caused in part by this virus, the HPV virus, that can be, certain strains can be, we can be made immune to them by this shot that is recommended for young girls. Am I summarizing that correctly?
Absolutely. The human papillomavirus causes cervical cancer, and the vaccine given to girls before they become sexually active is very effective at reducing their rates of acquiring the virus and then cervical cancer later on.
Is there a demonstrated impact? I know a lot of people's objection to this has to do with the fact that that vaccine in particular would give young women the message that unfettered sexual activity is now safe and not problematic. I mean, have you heard that from your patients, Liz? Is there an attitude like that among young women?
Absolutely not. And I think that the people that argue against the vaccine would probably be the same people that argue against sex education in school and provision of safe and effective contraception for young women to prevent unplanned pregnancies. There's really among patient populations that for whom this vaccine would be highly beneficial, there's really no discussion as to, oh, now I have a free pass to be as sexually promiscuous as I'd like. That just doesn't happen.
Yeah, and also I think to the contrary of that, you know, you have some countries, particularly Rwanda, is sort of looking at the time to give a vaccine, which is, you know, girls who are about ready to enter puberty, as a way of helping them enter young womanhood. So teaching them about their bodies, telling them about how it's going to be changing, helping them think about what their education is going to be and their future is going to be at the same time that they're giving them the vaccine. Mm-hmm. So actually using this period to vaccinate a girl as to protect her from a host of other things that she would otherwise succumb to had she not had that conversation, had she not had that engagement with the provider.
So you protect her with education and you protect her with the vaccine.
Absolutely.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have an email here from Valerie who wants to know about your views on the rise of home births and midwifery in America. Valerie says there's a cry for more mother-friendly care.
Well, thank you, Valerie, for the topic. You're right. I think that it's not as commonly seen in the South, but I know from having recently practiced in the Northeast, that is a very high market for home deliveries, for midwifery care. I think mother and baby friendly institutions in general are very important to young women and women, really all women having babies these days. There are definitely initiatives. You can see billboards all over Dallas of hospitals touting their wonderful women and infant centers because there's an effort all around for everyone to really become more attractive as far as the services provided to moms. As far as an opinion about home births, I think that Obviously, every woman has to make their own individual decisions about where they will have their children. As a physician, my preference is always going to be to deliver my patients in a hospital where I can have ready access to the many many surprising outcomes that can come from a delivery, no matter how normal the pregnancy and no matter how normal the labor process. But do I believe that sometimes hospitals and physicians can intervene in an unnecessary manner that can lead to some harm and some bad outcomes? Yes. And I can see why some women seek out that opportunity to deliver in a calmer, more quieter fashion, such as in the home.
How does the cost of providing something like prenatal care compare with a surprise complication that arises in the delivery room? You know, in other words, if someone has not had care all along and there is a recognizable issue with mother or child, how does the cost of having paid for multiple visits during the pregnancy compare?
Well, that's really a no-brainer, Chris. The cost of getting regular prenatal care and trying to find issues that can become complications later on in the delivery suite is minuscule compared to what actually the cost of the complication. And if you want to talk about a very large and unmeasurable cost would be the death of a mother.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that when we have women who are delaying pregnancy, are older at time of delivery, and they bring with them the higher rates of diabetes, hypertension, and obesity, those complications really become exponential, and those potential poor outcomes at time of delivery is very, very high.
We're talking about mothers and children's health this hour with Dr. Elizabeth Melendez of Methodist Health Systems and Dr. Eric Bing, Global Health Director for the George W. Bush Institute and author of the new book, Pharmacy on a Bicycle. We'll resume the conversation in a moment. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Dr. Eric Bing, who is a professor of global health at SMU and also global health director at the George W. Bush Institute, and Dr. Elizabeth Melendez, interim director for the Obstetrics and Gynecology Residency Program for Methodist Health Systems. They were both part of a panel discussion on maternal and childhood health last week at the Bush Presidential Center, sponsored by the United Way of Greater Dallas and the Kimberly-Clark Corporation. If you want to be part of this conversation, you can send email to think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372. And Eric, you wanted to follow up, I know, on what Liz was saying a few minutes ago.
And absolutely. I mean, you had, Liz very aptly said that this was a no-brainer about early prenatal care, avoiding outcomes. So one thing that we talked about is the impact on the mother. But the other really serious issue is the potential impact on the child. You know, while a lot of children die, many, many more are harmed or disabled through the birthing process or because they didn't get prenatal care. And this is a lifelong problem that will affect their ability to be educated, be able to support themselves, and ultimately society has to take care of these children.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Emmanuel in Arlington. Hi, Emmanuel.
Hi. Nice taking my call. And I wanted to congratulate the folks, you know, the panel, because what they are doing. I'm not in the medical field. I'm a teacher. And, you know, I taught at Callalen High School. This is in Corpus Christi, the DAP, which is a disciplinary alternative education program. Pretty difficult kid, but I was successful 2 years in a row, 100% passing rate in math. Why I was successful, it's basically because from my accent, you can see that I was born not here, although I'm a U.S. citizen now. I was born in Cameroon, which is West Central Africa. And I did use the perspective, the approach, the methodology of teaching, you know, my teacher used when I was growing up. And, you know, those kids needed sometimes just the parents at home. So nobody talked to them about being an engineer. When I came the first day, I did let them know that, okay, I went to one of the best engineering school in Europe. I'm an engineer. I'm here to help you. You know, they start trusting me. And then those kids spread the message, you know. The second year, everyone wanted to go to DAP. While there was what we call normal students, you know, everyone wanted to come to the DAP program because Emmanuel is over there. So thank you, folks. It's basically, you know, we can learn a lot from the third world country, and I entirely agree with you. So the radio I'm listening while I'm driving,
Drive safely, Emmanuel. We sure appreciate your call. And it does sort of speak to the value of education and that it doesn't have to be a really pedantic process that I would imagine you can engage people even better if you can form a relationship with them and really get people feeling invested in their own health.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I think, you know, one of the things that Emmanuel, you know, really helped point out is that in some ways it doesn't make a difference in where this good information comes from, where the role models come from, where the expectations that for success can come from. As long as a child can get it, that can also be enough.
So let's talk a little bit about something that's come up a couple times already this hour, and that is the so-called lifestyle-related diseases, that things like obesity and hypertension and heart disease and lung disease from smoking, things that behaviors play a significant role in. What do you do to communicate with people who may have been raised and for a matter of decades been living and acting and sort of making choices in a certain way? How do you begin to change those behaviors?
So I think one way needs to come on a broader, more societal manner, and that's by investing time, energy, and money in improving parks and recreation systems so that our children growing up in these low socioeconomic settings have access to outdoor living and play and improve upon their ability to exercise. Another one is access to fresh fruits and vegetables, which unfortunately is not the norm in all communities. Things like community gardens, introducing kids at an early age to appropriate nutrition instead of having every corner mall with a liquor store and a fast food joint. Those are, I think, more societal norms that need to change for these communities. That's not to say that the only people suffering from these diseases come from these low socioeconomic settings, because certainly it happens among the more affluent, but it is disproportionately represented more often in these communities. And I think it is because of a lack of access to, like I said, safe outdoor living and appropriate nutritional opportunities.
Yeah, I think so. Along with that, it's creating access to these important sort of life enhancing environments, but it also is changing social norms that it's expected and that people begin to want to do it. If you sort of look at some of, you know, the work on obesity, you know, we're affected by our social network. So, and same thing with smoking, that if people around you are doing this, you're more likely to do it. And so I think as we begin to change expectations and begin to sort of change the way communities are talking about this and thinking about this and also then working on it, we'll actually be able to begin to change some of these behaviors.
A lot of people question the idea of hunger in this country because they see particularly people who are struggling financially
very often also struggle with keeping their weight at an appropriate amount. And years past, that was, you know, having enough calories. These days, it's often having too many calories. But can you talk about the sort of relationship between food insecurity and actually people who gain too much weight over time or make choices that have to do sort of with cheap calories versus nutritious calories?
Well, I think all you really have to do is go to a grocery store and see how much cheaper it is to buy a bag of potato chips and a 12-pack of soda versus the fruits and vegetables in the produce aisle. It's even way cheaper to go and buy something at a fast food restaurant to feed your kids in a fast manner because there's no time to actually cook a nutritious meal at home. I think that there is a monetary cost to healthy living, and there's also a time expenditure that has to go into play in terms of planning that meal, cooking that meal, and making sure that you have time to put it on the table for your family. And I think that when you look at some of our moms who are struggling to make ends meet, they are having to work multiple jobs and often don't have the opportunity either financially to purchase those more nutritious foods, but don't have the time to actually cook them either.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We know in this country that there are people who, because they feel like they can't afford health care when they're a little bit sick, sort of put off receiving care until they're quite ill. Is that also the case in the developing world? And are there, I mean, with overwhelmed health systems or rural areas where there simply aren't facilities to provide health, are there similar efforts to get people to try to access care earlier, or do those resources simply just not exist?
I think you know, it's an important question because access to these preventative services are really important. And if you don't have resources, you're not going to do it often. And so it really is sort of making sure that these things are accessible and are at low cost. So one of the things that's really began to happen in developing countries is using smart entrepreneurs to actually sort of go out there and begin to give them the basic skills where they can begin to get access or make these things too marketable to these low-income communities. And so they're actually able to help people get access to basic health care while making a small profit. And if you sort of think about it, you know, we've always used these entrepreneurs. They're often called traditional healers, traditional birth attendants, curanderas, or all these different types of things that our communities are used. They've always been around, and these are entrepreneurs who are doing them.
Do we need to, in some ways, reframe family health as an economic issue in terms of productivity and school attendance and the ability to sort of feel good every day and get done what you need to get done?
I think absolutely, Chris. I think that it's fallacy for us to think that an individual's health is only their problem. It's a societal problem. If a mother doesn't access care for her unborn child during pregnancy, that child delivers preterm with multiple problems. The cost for that child to make it out of infancy and into adulthood. Affects the community at large. The cost of a patient not accessing appropriate care towards their whatever lifestyle issue you want to say is going to be a cost that we all pay down the line when that patient ends up with end-stage renal disease and on dialysis or whatever other long-term complications can arise from it. Their inability to function productively in society because of their health care issues also significantly impacts the community at large. And I think that for us to continue to couch the conversation surrounding health care as just an individual's issue and problem really are unproductive.
Absolutely. And I think that society ultimately bears the cost of this one way or the other because we have ill people who are unable to contribute to society and then we and that really affects us all.
As the Affordable Care Act continues to cover more U.S. citizens and ostensibly, and we're at the end of the hour, we can't debate this, but provide coverage for more people, we still have a huge population, particularly in Texas, particularly in this area, of undocumented immigrants who under no circumstances are covered. What does that do to people who in this community are trying to provide health services, and does it change the balance of sort of public-private partnerships and nonprofits and philanthropies that are trying to provide care?
Yeah, and I will make a correction. Texas does provide emergency Medicaid services to pregnant women.
Oh, okay.
Thank you. Regardless for the correction. of their immigration status. So we do see quite a number of patients through our Methodist health system that come in with this assistance. What's unfortunate about it is while it covers their prenatal care and their labor and delivery care, it doesn't provide for any contraception needs for these women. So as soon as they have these babies, they now have no coverage for anything beyond that. So it's a shame. It's one part that I wish we could have more access to. Definitely public-private partnerships have contributed towards quite a bit of care for these patients through Methodist health system. We're able to provide care for patients at subsidized rates. So we have women that come in needing gynecologic care that we are able to provide even without them being insured. It comes at a subsidized cost. They're able to pay in payments, and some of these patients come in with cash for their care because it is so important for them to get better. And so I think the assumption that somehow these patients are draining our medical system is really a false one. We've engaged in many partnerships with patients who have contributed significantly towards their own well-being from a financial perspective.
And I think, you know, just along with that, one of the things that this is really going to force us to do is to be innovative and entrepreneurial about ways of getting access to care to these people who aren't going to have it otherwise. In many developing countries, they don't have health insurance, but they just have to do it differently. I think that ultimately we're all going to end up paying a cost for this if they don't get care. So I think it's going to push us to be very creative about how we do this.
Dr. Eric Bing is professor of global health at SMU and global health director for the George W. Bush Institute. He's also got a new book out called Pharmacy on a Bicycle, Innovative Solutions to Global Health and Poverty. Dr. Elizabeth Melendez is interim director for the Obstetrics and Gynecology Residency Program for Methodist Health Systems. It's been wonderful to have you both here. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Chris.
My pleasure.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. We had production assistance from Lindsay Connect and Joe Bellotti on the phones. Our podcast is produced by Christine McConnell, and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can download the podcast free at kera.org/think and send any comments, questions, or suggestions for the show to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.